The National Security Podcast is taking a short break for the holidays, so we're revisiting some of our most popular episodes from 2023. From all of us at the ANU National Security College, happy holidays.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm David Andrews. Today's podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and I pay my respects to their elders, past and present. Today I'm joined by Darren Linville from Clemson University in South Carolina and Will Grant from the Australian National University to discuss online disinformation and social media forensics. Darren is an associate professor and co-director of the Clemson University Media Forensics Hub, and he studies state-affiliated social media information operations. Will is associate professor in science communication at the Australian National Centre for the Public Awareness of Science at ANU. Welcome, Darren and Will.
Thanks, David. It's great to be here.
Thank you.
Darren, I think I'll start with you as our guest from across the oceans, but I'm sure many people will be wondering, what is social media forensics? So perhaps you could tell us a little bit about that field of research and your work with the Media Forensics Hub.
Sure. The Media Forensics Hub at Clemson uses open source investigations techniques. That's, you know, non-classified information available primarily on the web to try to understand the strategy and tactics of bad actors and to work at understanding the authenticity of information that you're, digital information that you're finding on the web. So is this image what it purports to be? Is it where it purports to be? Is this account or individual a real person? Is this group of accounts working in collaboration with one another? Are they authentic? Are they inauthentic? That sort of thing. So we work with our undergraduates to teach them some of these techniques. We work with other professors at other universities to develop new techniques, and you know, we try to share a lot of what we learn with the social media platforms, with folks in the government. And that's what I'm here doing here in Australia as well, is collaborating with colleagues at Queensland University of Technology and here at ANU.
Great. Thanks so much for being here. It's great to have you with us. And I understand that, Will, you and Darren have done some work together in the past. Is that right?
Yes, we have. So we met a few years ago, and I'm interested in social media, and I'm, from a science perspective, very interested in how misinformation, which is disinformation's slightly nicer little sister. So disinformation is deliberate. Misinformation is just stuff that's not true, spreads through social media. And one of the things that I'm super interested in is that a lot of misinformation about science is spread through social media. And so we did some work looking at some of the Russia tweets, seeing how we could categorize those. These are Russia tweets coming from the Internet Research Agency that Darren will explain more in a bit. And looking at what components of them might be directed about destabilizing people's ideas about vaccines or climate change or other topics like that of controversial science.
Okay, wonderful. And you just touched on, Will, the difference between disinformation and misinformation, and perhaps that's useful for us just to sort of dig a little bit more into for those that might not be aware and might see the words in the newspaper and think that all sounds a little bit complicated. So, Darren, perhaps could you embellish a little bit more for us that distinction between disinformation and misinformation, and perhaps is one more of a threat than the other, or are they comparable in terms of their impact?
Well, I mean, you know, it's really a Venn diagram with a lot of overlap between the two. Disinformation is information that's wrong and purposefully wrong and purposely spread. So, for instance, the work of the Internet Research Agency, other bad actors, Chinese disinformation, Venezuelan disinformation, they're spreading falsehoods and they're doing it purposely, usually with some agenda in mind. Whereas misinformation is just anyone spreading any information that is incorrect. And so disinformation can sometimes become misinformation depending on who's actually sharing the message. If the many normal users of social media around the world that hit retweet on a Russian tweet back in 2016 or all the way through 2020, were spreading misinformation often just by hitting retweet on information that they had no reason to doubt, but was in fact, disinformation in its roots.
One of the things you can add to that is, well, that disinformation, clearly, if it's spread for deliberate harms, as Darren's just saying, there are bad actors that are spreading false information for deliberate purposes. Misinformation, too, can be also super harmful. I often talk about examples of misinformation that spread at the beginning of the pandemic. You might all remember stories of people in Iran drinking industrial alcohol, thinking it was a cure to COVID. Obviously wasn't. And led to hundreds and hundreds of deaths. So they're clearly related problems of problematic information spreading through the ecosystem that is worth coming together to try to solve.
And it's a problem that social media, it's not unique to social media, but it's certainly a problem that's exacerbated by social media because information just moves so quickly on social media. Often the misinformation spreads faster than facts can keep up, as we know that happened with the pandemic.
I think it's a feature in Twitter at any rate jumps to mind for me, which is in the last couple of years there was that notification that would pop up when you retweeted something or quote tweeted something. Do you want to read the article first?
Right.
Which strikes me as a pretty deliberate technical attempt to try and sort of pull back on some of those measures. And I'm not sure how much Mr. Musk is necessarily keeping some of those factors in place, but I think it points to that very point you've made about the constant repetitive cycling nature of social media and the way it can so rapidly spread. One other word I just wanted to get some clarity on, because I feel it's perhaps misused or used in quite a broad brush sense, is the concept of an internet troll. And I think we often might apply that word sort of pejoratively to an individual who is sort of badgering someone online or just being a bit annoying. But then we also talk about troll farms or factories and sort of this large scale system. So are both of them fair uses of the term? What would you think of technically speaking as researchers looking at that?
Yeah, it is a word that you really have to pay attention to the context to understand how somebody's using it. It does come originally from people that are just annoying on social media. More and more you see it being used as in fact, I use it as an almost technical term when I'm talking about inauthentic accounts online. And it may be the case that, you have a farm of people that are running a number of accounts and you'll have, a room full of people running social media accounts, but it's absolutely important to differentiate between a troll, which is an account run by a real person, and a bot, which is an account that's wholly or at least mostly automated.
One of the things I've always found fascinating in your work as well, Darren, is that there are clear overlaps in terms of strategy and tactics because, we look at this from a communications perspective and thinking about how people use communication in a strategic way to achieve ends. And for both the individual troll and for the farm troll, wherever in the internet research agency or anywhere, there are similar overlapping ways of using disingenuous communication to achieve a certain end. Sure, the farms involve a whole lot more people and a whole lot more strategic uses, but there is definitely an overlap in using certain forms of questioning, certain forms of assertion to make people think differently.
Yeah, I certainly got the sense, I've read Russian IRA tweets until my eyes have bled. And I've certainly got the sense from reading some of them that, maybe they got their start in their mom's basement as an old-fashioned troll and that got them the job working for the IRA.
Look, and maybe it's just that is the form of communication that works well on the internet. Like it is, the internet privileges or allows anonymous forms of communication like we just didn't have in older media. So now people can say things anonymously. They can say it quickly. They can dive into mentions. They can do all sorts of things like that. So perhaps this form of communication grew up with the internet. And whether that person graduated from basement to factory or whether the people planning the factory said, all right, well, let's use the tactics of the people in the basement, there's clearly a strong overlap between the two.
And there's just a way of speaking in many online communities that if you if you don't engage in that way, you'll stand out, and you know, you won't get the retweets, you won't get the followers, you won't get the impressions.
So a group you've both mentioned a few times now is the Internet Research Agency, which, to my understanding, is a part of the Russian state that is focused on this sort of disinformation work. And I think it was actually some comment was made in the news recently that turns out that the head of the Wagner Group is actually the sort of the originator or founder of this organization. So perhaps you could tell us a bit more about particularly the Russian disinformation process, because they seem to be the, at least by reputation, sort of the world leaders in these state-sponsored disinformation campaigns.
Yeah, the Internet Research Agency dates back to early 2014. You're right, it's an organization that is owned by Yevgeny Prigozhin, Putin's chef, as he's sometimes called, the owner of the Wagner Group. And they got their start trolling, like the Chinese have done, and the Venezuelans have done, and other groups. They got their start trolling domestically, so trolling their fellow Russians, as well as Ukrainians in 2014. And then somewhere in early to mid 2015, they started, you know, looking abroad and trolling other nations, specifically the United States, but you know, the broader West as well. They had a number of accounts that were engaging in French and German. They trolled on issues affecting Australia, affecting the UK. Certainly, they communicate a lot about Brexit. And they got really, really good at their job. They had accounts that, you know, had hundreds of thousands of followers, millions of mentions in the run-up to the 2016 election. And fundamentally, they were working to divide the West and polarize our conversations and make it harder for democracies to function. I think fundamentally, even more fundamentally than that, they were working to make it easier for Putin to work with a more free hand in Russia. They wanted to make sure that the Russian people didn't look to the West and think that the grass was greener on the other side, that, you know, things were better there, because as long as they, you know, maybe things aren't perfect in Russia, sure, but as long as they also weren't perfect in the West, then maybe the Russian people will just be satisfied. Certainly it was the perspective of the Kremlin that the Internet Research Agency had done a good job, because after 2016 they moved into a much bigger office.
Can I just add to this? I think it's fascinating to see this history, because it has clear precedence in Soviet action during the Cold War. So in the 1970s and 1980s, there were clearly KGB attempts, particularly aimed at America, but aimed at other countries around the world, some in Africa, some in India as well, to sow forms of disinformation that would lead to community unrest. So they definitely tried to polarize America more during the civil rights movement. They definitely tried to sow AIDS denialism in the 1980s to undermine, you know, undermine shared institutions, shared trust in institutions. And so while clearly this is a new organization, clearly has antecedents that, you know, Putin's thinking in the KGB certainly grew into this sort of arena here.
Well, one thing I was going to ask, which I think you've sort of preempted, is the extent to which this is a new phenomenon, or one that is really just sort of the newest iteration of a more established sort of trend. And I was thinking particularly of the 2016 presidential election, and I think that's perhaps where some of these processes came more to the public consciousness. And I guess it's maybe notable that the IRA was established only a couple of years before that, and there's some interesting overlaps there. Is that maybe a fair characterization, that this is just the newest, most prominent version of a more established trend?
I think that's 100% true. And what's interesting, if you look at the data, if you look at the information that our lab has released and that Twitter has released of what the IRA was doing from starting in 2015 in targeting foreign conversations and in targeting conversations in English on Twitter specifically, but across a number of other platforms. You can see that evolution happening in, as it was happening. You know, these broadly speaking, Will's right. These aren't, you know, brand new tactics. It's the evolution of old tactics to new technologies. And you could see them learn how to do it. So their very early efforts in 2015 were really bad. I mean, they were comically bad. They were trying to convince Americans that there was a chemical explosion in Louisiana that never happened, or a salmonella outbreak on Thanksgiving of 2015 in upstate New York that never happened. And they were trying to blame the Koch brothers for it, because it was Koch family farms were responsible for this horrible salmonella outbreak and people were dying. But they got no traction for these stories, and they utterly failed, even though they were using, you know, thousands of accounts to try to make these stories trend online. Because, you know, Americans, we like to pretend that we don't trust our media. But the truth of the matter is, when it comes to did this thing happen, we really do. You know, when it comes to is there a chemical explosion in Louisiana, we're going to trust CNN on that. And you can see this moment in time in late 2015 where they clearly brought in consultants or something. I don't know, but they became a marketing company instead of, you know, just trying to do exactly the same thing that the GRU had done. And they really took off quite quickly and got very good at their job.
This is the thing, though, as communications people that study communications, that's the thing that social media offers you, is you can try so many campaigns, whereas maybe you couldn't try so many in older times in traditional media, and you get data all the time. Every single tweet, you can get a little bit of data telling you, okay, this one got more engagement, this one got more retweets, more likes. And so if you're you're bringing those marketing consultants, and suddenly you can go, okay, actually, if you want to have impact, we can measure it. We can study all these things all the way along. And this is the same stuff that all of the other corporates are using on social media to try and understand. But it means that they can be far more successful in their efforts to generate the impact that they want.
And what's funny too is you can see them engaging in some of these experiments if you look at the data. So there's when you look at conversations that the trolls were having about the U.S. presidential debates in before the 2016 election, there were three presidential debates, and I don't remember the order they went, but for one presidential debate, the trolls all tried to engage with real users before the debate. With another debate, they all, you know, tried to engage users during the debate. And with the final debate, they all engaged with users after the debate. And it was clear that they were doing it to try to discover what had the best effect. Where were their most useful?
As a communication researcher, it's just so great seeing them doing some actual science, you know, to investigate. You have a little experimental condition, and then you test the different phenomena. You know, they didn't get ethics, though. So there's a no-no. Not going to get that published.
Right.
We'll be right back.
In this disrupted world, Australia needs security professionals more than ever. Join the next generation studying at the ANU National Security College. Our programs uniquely fuse academic knowledge with practitioner experience and fit around your lifestyle with study offered online and on campus. Follow the link in the show notes for more information about programs and scholarships. The ANU National Security College. Engaging minds for a secure Australia.
I don't know if this is an aspect of what you're just reflecting on there, but I think we've seen perhaps the evolution of some of these sort of fake accounts over time, from the original, the kind of the Twitter egg that sort of, you know, JPG nine digits, sort of zero followers, and they follow, you know, 1,000 people, to perhaps now it's more the sort of Jim or Mary Sue with sort of the eagle and the flag in the background, and equally with zero followers and lots of people they follow. And have you seen things like that, the sort of trend in the way that the actual expression or the avatars, I guess, of these troll farms, are they becoming more sophisticated and complex?
It depends on the troll farm, and it depends on the goals. So It's definitely true that if you looked at the work of the Internet Research Agency, they got far more complex. We developed methods of tracking their ongoing work and identifying, you know, active accounts that were active, you know, during the 2018 midterms in the U.S. and the 2020 election just before it. And they definitely got more sophisticated, and they were able to accrue followers very quickly. They had tweets that had hundreds of thousands of likes, tens of thousands of retweets. And
you told us that story just the other day, Darren, about one of the accounts getting tweet of the week in like an American newspaper.
Yeah, the Chicago Tribune.
Yeah, yeah, a big one.
Yeah, yeah, a not small paper. One of these trolls won the tweet of the week contest in October of 2018 from the Chicago Tribune, voted on by the readers of the Chicago Tribune. I believe the tweet was making fun of Trump in a book is unfair. It's like making fun of the Amish on television.
Yeah, that's a good tweet.
It's a good tweet.
That's a good tweet.
It's a solid tweet. But you know, it wasn't just their content that they got more sophisticated with. In 2020, they started using, actually in 2018, they started using computer generated profile images. So profile images that weren't real people. You can make your own computer generated profile image if you just go to thispersondoesnotexist.com, or you can get a cat that doesn't exist at thiscatdoesnotexist.com. And the Russians know this, and they use these tools to create profiles that are fake. But you know, just because that's what the Russians are doing and have done, you know, engaging in this very artisanal development and accrual of followers over time, and then using those followers, and they were very good at it.
Just to clarify, they're the hipsters of disinformation campaigns.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah, just because that's what the Russians are good at doesn't mean that everybody's following the Russian playbook. If you look at other nations, especially China, what they're doing. What China is doing is very different than what Russia has done in the past.
So speaking of China, I think that's maybe a useful sort of segue into perhaps something that people in Australia or in our part of the world are maybe worried a little bit more about than Russia. Maybe that's unwise. We should be concerned more about what the Russians are doing as well in this space. But how do the methods or the practices that are employed by Russia compare to those that are used by China that you've observed?
It's absolute apples and oranges. Now there are some similarities. You know, China relies very heavily on state media in the same way that Russia does. You know, Russia has Sputnik and RT, and China has Global Times and other platforms, and really, you know, on a dollar for dollar basis, this is the core of their propaganda. Targeting especially English-speaking populations, but elsewhere as well. And RT is one of the fastest-growing media groups in Latin America, for instance. There are some definite similarities, but a lot of what China does is not about engaging in conversation. They're not trying to persuade individuals. So if you look at a Chinese troll account, it does look like what you said, you know, a random name with a random string of numbers after it and a really unlikely looking profile image. They look fake on the surface, you know, no followers, no following. But what they're trying to do isn't the same thing. They're trying to make sure conversations don't happen. So I sometimes say that Russian trolls care about what you think of your neighbor. Chinese trolls only care about what's important to China. And so they will often flood conversations. So conversations, especially about things like what's happening in Xinjiang with the Uyghur minorities, or what's happening around specific stories about China. So there's a recent story about Chinese global policing, China running police centers in cities around the United States, or around the world, not just the United States.
These are focused on Chinese citizens that are in other countries.
Targeting Chinese expats and Chinese citizens abroad. and the Chinese diaspora. And they will, you know, flood conversations and the hashtags that people use to have these conversations to make it harder for those conversations to happen. So famously, it's actually, to my knowledge, K-pop fans that did this for the first time, I think back in 2019 or so, around the hashtag White Lives Matter, I think it was. The hashtag White Lives Matter was trending during Black Lives Matter protests in the United States. And K-pop fans took that hashtag over so that it couldn't be used for racist reasons, but it was just being used to talk about K-pop. And the Chinese do that, but, you know, they will use hashtag Uyghur genocide and just tell you about how wonderful and beautiful things are in Xinjiang and how clean and lovely the cotton is in Xinjiang. And there's no, you know, absolutely no forced labor going into the cotton industry in Xinjiang. I think it's likely that there's also algorithmic goals for this. You know, Twitter and other platforms aren't going to tell us the algorithmic effect on it. But I think it's likely that these types of tactics, suppress the potential of these hashtags trending. But yeah, you'll see Chinese trolls constantly using hashtags that are utterly counterintuitive. So in the run up to the Beijing Olympics, for instance, thousands of Chinese troll accounts were using hashtag genocide games, which is a lovely little hashtag. It's got alliteration. It combines multiple concepts into one condensed message, and I think it's very likely that I watched it in real time as real users started using genocide games, and then the Chinese troll accounts inserted themselves into these conversations with the hashtag. And then the hashtag just kind of slowly disappeared, and the only people you saw using it were the Chinese trolls. So, it's not just issues that they do this with; they also do it with people. You see them flooding, especially Chinese expats and Chinese dissidents abroad. They will create 1,000 versions of that person's social media account on multiple platforms, so that, you know, you can't tell who the real Chinese dissident is on social media. And it's scary when you see this happen in mass, because it's clearly something they've invested in. And like the Russians, I'm sure it's something that they've tested in controlled tests.
And now, of course, with at least on Twitter as sort of the common example, verification changes means that people who could perhaps have relied on that as a way of distinguishing themselves from the fake accounts are now just someone that pays $8 a month can
say
what they want.
Absolutely.
They? Well, hence all of those other trolls, the basement trolls, spending quite a bit of time on Twitter pretending to be official government accounts or NASA or something like that to tweet things that they otherwise wouldn't. So, you know.
Yeah, maybe one day Elon will be making a lot of money off of Chinese troll accounts, spending their $8 a month.
Well, we've spoken quite a bit about the state-based or sort of, I guess, state-related approaches to disinformation and misinformation. But are there more domestically oriented models of this as well, whether it's sort of issue motivated groups or just individuals? Are there ways that these techniques are employed for still malign intent, but in more sort of compressed contexts?
Look, I think there's a couple of really interesting examples here. Darren was telling some good stories to me yesterday about the Cat Turd 2 account. I know that's not a thing that's normally discussed here. Very much focused on domestic politics in America. But you can also see a number of similar sorts of accounts here in Australia that are not necessarily aimed at destabilization, but at pushing their particular political orientation. So you will absolutely get accounts that are pushing a left or a right perspective and using a variety of the techniques to show things in a certain light, to frame issues in a certain way, or to take pictures in a certain way that will get communities involved. One of the stories that Darren was telling is, Biden's
Bear Shelves Biden.
Bear Shelves Biden. And you can, you know, if you show a lot of pictures and tweet regularly about them and get people to engage with them and then get a community around that, then you can develop a following for that, even if it is not necessarily true. So it is quite easy in social media to turn what might be objectively a very minor story, you know, or even a non-story into something that people believe might be true if they already want to. And this is one of the interesting things that we're studying as well in disinformation, is that to spread further, much disinformation needs fertile ground. It needs a fertile ground of people who are ready to believe that or want to push it further. And so here in Australia, for example, you'll get people on the far left, far right, other sorts of places who will definitely take up forms of disinformation and say, well, this agrees with my agenda, so I'm going to retweet that further. I'm going to develop a community around that.
I think this account that Will was talking about, this Cat Turd 2, not to be confused with Cat Turd 1, really points to what we were talking about earlier, too, about the differences in that we see with social media as compared to old ways of spreading propaganda and traditional media. In particular, that, you know, this account has 500,000 followers on Twitter and growing influence on other platforms. And it's turned the idea of credibility on its head. It now has a blue check mark, and the New York Times does not. This account, Cat Turd 2, and it gets tens of thousands of likes and retweets and other forms of engagement, and can really ultimately shape the messaging of the traditional media. So if Cat Turd 2 wakes up, you know, one morning and decides, oh, I'm going to make a story trend, that account is capable of doing that. And it's just a person. And, you know, and that's the type of person that would name their account Cat Turd 2.
Perhaps we'll, just for the local audience, I thought I'd reflect on some of our, the Australian experience of COVID in particular. I think that's a pretty ripe area for both misinformation and disinformation. We had the convoy to Canberra that the good residents of the ACT were thrilled to receive, as well as the wider questions around lockdowns and vaccines and origins of the virus and all these sorts of things. As a science communicator and as, you know, someone working in this space, what sort of reflections do you have on the Australian experience of this?
Look, I think there's a lot of things to say here. One is we do have similar-ish politics to what is going on in America, but we are not in that place where America is. But there are definitely efforts by a variety of people to import political issues from outside to whip up different sorts of fervor. I think if we turn directly to COVID and the sorts of politics that we saw during that time, there was definitely a fertile ground. There were a lot of people who felt the lockdowns were pretty rough. And I think whether you support them or not, you could find them pretty rough. There are a lot of people who thought maybe they were too far and that vaccine mandates were not something that they supported. So there was fertile ground at that point for a lot of people to drift into more libertarian styles of politics than they might have thought about in 2019. But with that also came a lot of people that then perhaps developed a more credulous approach to the news. And so where those people might have said, well, I don't like the lockdown, then they're getting ideas of, okay, these are the vaccines are microchips from Bill Gates, or the vaccines are to control us, or they don't work, or they're dated, all of those kinds of things. They spread on fertile ground. But absolutely, when you get groups of people that come together, and there are forms of, we'll call it at least misinformation at the moment, that seek to destabilize what had previously been sort of middle of the road government messaging. So vaccines are good, which is supported by, you know, all mainstream science and all mainstream political parties. So the message that vaccines are problematic did find fertile ground amongst these sorts of people and then pulls them to more marginal communities. So I think it's doing a few things. It's destabilizing for many countries in the West, sort of the institutions of trust of which we hope science is one. And we hope, you know, the sort of middle of the road government agencies, Department of Health, we kind of hope those are one. And so there is that destabilization of those institutions of trust, and people become more polarized out to far left or far right or far other sorts of perspectives. So I think we are definitely in a place that is, was ripe for that. I don't know if that stays in 2022, 2023, but clearly social media does have a big impact on our politics and will into the future.
Yeah, I do want to say, Will, you're not as bad as the United States yet.
Look, and that is always the huge question for those of us following domestic politics here in Australia or in any country, because, you know, as many have said, where goes the US, we will follow. And so there are certainly efforts to, you know, you can see in the US right now whipping up more fervor around trans issues and LGBTQI. There's a few more attempts to do that in other countries. So we've seen that in the UK and Australia. And now it's not a direct import, but what that is doing is perhaps polarizing different countries. Now, polarization for those people who are on the extreme, that's their goal, because that makes them more likely to have impact and power. But there are other people that like polarization for what it does to countries, and that's clearly the Russian effort.
Yeah, I mean, it's a simple fact that one obvious thing about social media that affects this entire conversation is it doesn't have national boundaries. You know, the Russians, for instance, when they were targeting conversations in Australia or in the UK, they were using the same English-speaking accounts. They didn't create persona that were pretending to be British or persona that were pretending to be Australian. They were using the same English language accounts that they were using to target the Americans. And many of these conversations are increasingly becoming global conversations, even on social media. So that's just one example that related to.
I was just going to add. I think, you know, your listeners would be, you know, often used to thinking about the big geopolitics, you know, buying submarines or you know, the international race for microchips, you know, and how we move energy around the world, and yeah, the geopolitical conflict between China and the US. Of course, you know, that frames a lot of what is going on. But I think all of these issues do weave in together, you know, as Australia plays a certain role. As we move in a certain direction, then there are global efforts that might push back against that. So I think, yes, we can look at this and say, okay, part of this is a social media problem. But I think actually, and that's the correct thing from Darren's perspective, is if you only study misinformation or disinformation from a social media perspective, then you're missing out on the fact that absolutely there are deliberate actors that are using this for certain sorts of ends.
I think certainly that internationalized, globalized form of communication resonates with me in terms of a lot of the big figures that we see in the who, whether willingly or unintentionally, spread some of these points of misinformation, whether it's the sort of the Joe Rogans or Andrew Tates and those sort of characters of the world who have a global following and also build a pretty tidy income off the back of spreading these mistruths. And I think in that sense, often in Australia, we might pat ourselves on the back and say, no, we're much more sort of communitarian. We're not quite as libertarian. We have a different political system. It's not the same as America, which at one level is true. But as you say, Darren, that's not a fixed reality. And especially as these communicators, for want of a better word, these people who are spreading these messages for their own reasons, that's speaking to different generations and different groups of people in a way that doesn't respect the Westminster system or a presidential election. It's much more pervasive than that.
Yeah. There are plenty of fans of Alex Jones and QAnon in Australia. Mm. And to that broader point too, David, I think it's important to point out that, you know, the most common form of troll account on social media, of a fake account on social media, is really just an account trying to steal your money. As has probably been the case with past technologies spreading propaganda as well, is that, you know, and a lot of the accounts responsible for spreading disinformation are really just accounts trying to take your money in one form or another, whether it's selling vitamins or selling t-shirts, they just want your money.
One of the other ones that I just wanted to add into in terms of the ways that these conversations are clearly global. You know, who is the worst Australian terrorist in recent years? You know, we don't spend enough time, but he went and did terrible things in New Zealand. And clearly that forms a pattern of global misogynistic violence. So there are clearly people like him who are reading the forums. Maybe it's Andrew Tate, maybe it's in other places. I don't know where they are reading these things. But there is Islamophobic, anti-trans, misogynistic sorts of hate that is clearly getting people to take up arms and do terrible things. And that's spreading absolutely globally. And so while we may not shift the center of our politics, maybe that doesn't change, there are certainly very fringe people that are becoming weaponized or who are turning to forms of violence that I don't think they would have done in years gone by.
Well, certainly in the case of that individual who I think we'll elect not to name, who went to New Zealand and carried out those attacks, his actions then subsequently flowed on and inspired others, I believe, in Norway to do similar things. So it's just an example of that sort of continuing spiral of the way these things interact. But I thought before we finish, we shouldn't leave on quite such a sort of somber and downcast note, but actually we need to be thinking about perhaps how we respond or what we can do or how we can overcome some of these challenges. So I think I'd like to suspect that we need to observe them and understand them and work out what the intentions of these actors are and what they might be trying to extract from our communities and our societies. But that doesn't mean we don't have options of our own in terms of response and sort of building a stronger society. So perhaps as my final question, I might just ask you both to reflect on, well, how can we counter these measures? How can we do better and strengthen our societies in response?
I think it's important to point out that in many respects, we are doing better already. Russia doesn't have the run of the platforms like they did back in 2016 when they were literally paying for Facebook ads with rubles. So we are doing marginally better. I think we're doing marginally better, though, in English language conversations. I know you told me not to end on a downbeat, but I think many of the real dangers that we're not talking about are the disinformation and misinformation spreading in the non-English world. And at the end of the day, those conversations are going to affect us in the English language world as well. I think that, you know, some of these issues are addressed because the platforms see the conversations that are happening in English as more important, and the potential of, you know, face harming news coming out about troll operations in targeting Australia or England or the US as important enough to address. But we really need to pay more attention to the non-English speaking world, because it's just rife with trolls.
I think the thing that I'll throw in here is that all of this problem lands in a landscape of declining trust. Throughout the West, we have had for quite a few decades declining trust in governments. And I think that is not a simple thing to just solve. We can't click your fingers and say, trust government more. And that's not what we should do. But speaking from my perspective in the world of science, and science being a key component of government, that absolutely a thing that we can and should do more is connect more with communities. If we drill directly down into the vaccine issue, the reason that people turned hostile to vaccines is in part because we didn't really do enough work to understand their fears and to build policy around that that said, okay, we understand where you are. Perhaps there are ways to mitigate. Perhaps there are ways to work with you. And I know that government has to move fast sometimes, but there is more that we in the sciences can do, more that we in the sort of public health or the wider community relations world can do to engage more with communities. So I think there is more that we can all do to talk more and connect more and trust more. So, but that is a big long-term project. But if you want another solution to our social media giants, maybe we just internationalize them. Maybe just, you know, instead of allowing corporate behemoths that are literally trillion-dollar companies. Okay, Twitter's not a trillion-dollar company, but many of these companies are huge, huge companies. Maybe we should recognize the fact that giant monopolies shouldn't be in the hands of tech bros. Maybe they should be in the hands of the wider community itself.
Yeah, they are not solving the problem. They're addressing it to the degree that they feel necessary. And at least in the case of some tech bros, even less than that.
Well, I think that's a really intriguing note to end on, and I'll leave our listeners to ponder the possibilities of a nationalizing model of international social media. But Darren Linville and Will Grant, thank you so much for joining us on the National Security Podcast.
Great to be with you.
Thanks, David.